Who am I speaking with?
I want to remain anonymous. Is that okay?
Okay. What are you calling to report, sir?
The double homicide that happened in April this year.
What can you tell me about that?
Everything, actually.
The residential tree-lined neighborhood of Cowell Boulevard meanders through the heart of Davis in California. It's situated close to the bustling highway and not too far away from the pulse of the town center. Here, amidst the mostly single family homes and condominiums, lies number 4006, where 87-year-old Oliver Northup and his wife of 17 years, 76-year-old Claudia Morpin, made their home. With its modest 1,088 square feet, their home provided a snug retreat for the retired couple. But accommodating their large family of 9 children and 14 grandchildren could sometimes prove to be a challenge. At around 9:30 p.m. on the 14th of April 2013, the tranquility of Cowell Boulevard was disrupted when Davis police received a phone call from one of Claudia's adult daughters. She had become concerned by the lack of communication from her mother throughout the day, and repeated attempts to reach her had gone unanswered. When Oliver's children tried to reach out to him throughout the day as well, they received the same strange silence. The phone just rang and rang, but nobody answered it. It was a Sunday, and Oliver and Claudia hadn't shown up for a memorial service at the church, and Oliver had been scheduled to sing that day. Growing worried, their children had gone over to their home earlier in the evening. Upon arrival, they noticed that the Sunday newspaper was still lying untouched in the driveway, a detail that deepened their concern. As night fell, Officer Mark Herman arrived at the couple's light brown condominium after Claudia's daughter called 911. Despite the darkness outside, the interior blazed with light from within. The couple's car sat parked in the driveway, but repeated knocks on the front door yielded no response. Officer Herman searched the perimeter of the home and made an ominous discovery. One of the window screens had been slashed open. As he peered through the window, his view was obscured, but he was sure that he could see blood in the master bedroom. With caution, he entered the home with his firearm drawn. His calls to Oliver and Claudia echoed throughout the silent home. Moving through the meticulously arranged living room, Officer Herman proceeded towards the master bedroom. As he stepped inside, his eyes swept the space for any signs of Oliver and Claudia, before he was immediately drawn to the double bed. The once pristine sheets were stained crimson with blood, and Oliver and Claudia lay deceased on top of them. Oliver Northup was born to parents Eleanor and Oliver on the 26th of April 1925 in Grand Island, Nebraska. He had served in the United States Navy during World War II, following which he developed a profound passion for law. His academic pursuit led him to Bolt Hall School of Law and UC Berkeley, where he earned his undergraduate degree before venturing into the legal realm. Initially, Oliver embarked on his career as an appellate court clerk, later transitioning to the role of a prosecutor. He began in Sacramento and subsequently served the Yolo County District Attorney's Office. Opting for a new path, Oliver eventually departed from county employment to collaborate with 3 fellow attorneys, establishing Rogarts, Means, Northup & Estey, which is a civil law firm nestled in downtown Woodland. Within this role, Oliver specialized in what could be described as country lawyer work, often crafting land arrangements for local farmers. Those acquainted with Oliver characterized him as an English professor, disguised in the garb of a lawyer. While his devotion to law remained steadfast, his heart found solace in the realms of literature, where he meticulously preserved timeless passages of Western classics. Music also held sway over his soul, nurtured by the melodies sung by his father during his upbringing. In 1965, Oliver's passion for music culminated in the formation of the Pewter Creek Crawdads, a local folk band. Alongside fellow church members Captain Thomas, Mark Fay, and Ray Coppock, the quartet assembled their instruments for the first time during a church potluck dinner, setting the stage for their journey into the realm of music. Captain recollected, "Pretty soon, we find we all like to play the same old-timey folk music." He said that Oliver had this magical quality of remembering lyrics to songs that he knew years beforehand. While Oliver couldn't actually read music, once he had learned a tune, he could remember it right away. Then in 1996, Oliver crossed paths with Claudia Morpin at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Davis, a college town he had moved to in 1976. Claudia, who had been born on the 15th of May 1936, served as a pastoral associate there, while Oliver was a frequent visitor. Much like Oliver, Claudia had a passion for the arts, and she was actively involved in the local theatre scene. Their shared interest in literature and classic films ignited an instant connection between them. Claudia, who was a mother of three, and Oliver, who was a father of six, found themselves as empty nesters, drawing them closer together. Later that same year, Oliver and Claudia exchanged vows. On their wedding day, the two families stood behind the couple as they recited their vows. Instead of Oliver and Claudia saying the traditional "I do," the family, in unison, said "we do." Despite Oliver's prior experiences with marriage, having been married three times before and widowed, he approached his union with Claudia with even greater compassion and understanding. His children said that each marriage had taught him how to be a kinder and more loving person, so when he married Claudia, he applied the lessons he had learned from each past marriage. Their marriage resulted in a substantial blended family, comprising 9 children, 2 stepchildren, 14 grandchildren, and 8 great-grandchildren. All of Oliver and Claudia's children rejoiced in their parents' newfound love. Reflecting on the union, one of Oliver's daughters, Mary, remarked, "They were very happy together. I was very happy he was able to find somebody like that." Mary said that Claudia had the special ability to make every person she spent time with so special that they would come away and say that she was their best friend. The couple's relationship transcended mere marital bonds. They were confidants, companions, sharing every waking moment together. By 2013, 87-year-old Oliver and 76-year-old Claudia reveled in their well-deserved retirement. Claudia's earlier years were marked by her tenure as a phone company technician, while Oliver had served as a prosecutor. But Oliver wasn't quite ready yet to be fully retired, and he remained engaged in his legal career. Specializing in criminal appellate law, he imparted his wisdom through seminars at the Public Defender's Office. He furthered his commitment by undertaking criminal appellate defense work for the California Appellate Project, advocating for prison inmates who sought a second chance at justice. With an unwavering dedication to his clients' rights, Oliver's daughter Mary remarked, "He was a person who really believed in people getting their legal rights. He felt like he was doing good work and that he was helping. It was his way." After Officer Herman found Oliver and Claudia dead in bed, he took in the scene before him. There were countless stab wounds riddled across Oliver and Claudia's bodies. Oliver had sustained 61 stab wounds, while Claudia had 67. But the horrors didn't end there. Both Oliver and Claudia lay before Officer Herman, their bodies mutilated, dissected, and disemboweled. In that moment, Officer Herman felt a wave of dread wash over him, realizing that this was more than just a regular crime scene. As he radioed for help and began to assess the extent of their injuries, a surreal sight met his eyes. A cell phone was nestled within the gaping cavity of Claudia's stomach. Nearby, a drinking glass jutted out from Oliver's torn stomach. The murder investigation commenced promptly, with forensic experts meticulously scouring Oliver and Claudia's home for any traces of evidence. While signs of forced entry were evident, with one of the window screens sliced open, the absence of any indication of a burglary puzzled detectives. Recent burglaries in the neighbourhood, where thieves accessed homes by hopping fences behind the condominiums, added a layer of complexity to the case. However, the lack of stolen items led detectives to conclude that the intruder's sole intent was to murder Oliver and Claudia. Despite this, detectives were perplexed at a motivation. Oliver and Claudia were an elderly couple, and all of their friends and family said that they had no enemies. Oliver's youngest son, Robert, commented, "It's tragic that such generous and beautiful people would die violently, especially since they would have given the shirts off their back to anybody who needed it." His daughter, Mary, added, "Right now there's no clue, and it's really disconcerting. We have no idea." Meanwhile, forensic experts meticulously combed through every inch of the crime scene, searching for elusive evidence. Despite the frenzied and brutal nature of the attack, they found no fingerprints, footprints, or even any unidentified DNA. As the investigation intensified, the police department announced the deployment of additional patrols across the town as a preemptive measure to reassure the community. The shocking murders reverberated through the quiet college town, marking the first murder since 2011, when Kevin Seary was killed in his apartment. In hopes of identifying a suspect, a tip line was established for the community to provide information anonymously. Despite this effort, the flow of tips was scant, and those that did come in led nowhere. As weeks passed by, detectives found themselves at an impasse. Every person acquainted with the couple was interviewed, yet none could shed light on a potential suspect. All of Oliver and Claudia's children were interviewed and scrutinized, but they could offer no further insight and wanted the murders to be solved even more so than the detectives. Oliver and Claudia were universally regarded as amiable individuals with no known enemies. Everybody that they met became a friend to the couple. Despite the lack of leads, detectives remained committed to the investigation. Lieutenant Paul Dorshov of the Davis Police emphasized the gravity of the situation, stating, "This is our top priority. A breach of security in one's own home strikes at the core of our sense of safety. We're determined to uncover who is responsible and why." He appealed to the public once more, urging those with surveillance cameras to review their footage for any potential information. Two months following the murders, Davis police received a call from a jittery teenage boy named Alvaro Garbe.
"Is there a way to just remain anonymous, or to call another time?
You can leave whatever type of message you want to leave him. I mean, you don't choose to leave your phone number, but the only hard thing is, in case, I guess, they would have more questions. I mean, if you don't want to leave your real name, that's fine. You can make up a name or at least a contact number so they could at least just call you back if they had more questions. I don't know if you'd be willing to do that.
He expressed a desire to provide a tip regarding the double homicide that occurred in April. The 911 operator knew that he was talking about Oliver and Claudia. They asked, "What can you tell me about that?" Alvaro responded,
"I know everything, and it's really scary, actually, because he kind of threatened me and all that."
You have, like, the suspect information?
Yes, I know him. I know he told me everything that happened, everything he did, like, all the little details.
The 911 operator handed the call over to one of the detectives.
Who am I speaking with?
I want to remain anonymous. Is that okay?
Okay. What are you calling to report, sir?
The double homicide that happened in April this year.
What can you tell me about that?
Everything, actually.
Okay. And how is it that you were able to have all this information about it?
The person told me everything.
So you know who did it?
Yes.
Okay, let's start from the beginning.
Alvaro said that his best friend, 15-year-old Daniel Marsh, had confessed to the double murder to him, describing the killings in chilling detail with a disturbing smile on his face. Alvaro said that Marsh told him he cut Oliver and Claudia open because he wanted to see their insides. Initially skeptical, Alvaro's doubt dissipated when Marsh produced the purported murder weapon, a knife he claimed to have used. Marsh had also confessed to his girlfriend, who, along with Alvaro, grappled with the dilemma of what to do next. They were fearful of Marsh's potential retaliation, so at first, they hesitated to involve the police. Marsh's disturbing admission that the murders had given him an unparalleled sense of euphoria, coupled with his stated desire to kill again, only intensified their apprehension. However, events took a turn when Marsh's girlfriend ended their relationship, after he came to school with a knife. She promptly reported the incident to the school, resulting in Marsh's suspension. Despite this, Marsh snuck into his ex-girlfriend's home through the dog door later that night. Alarmed and unaware of their next move, the ex-girlfriend and Alvaro reconvened to discuss their options. Eventually, they finally decided to call police.
You said he disclosed this to you a few nights after the actual death of these people, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Why do you think he disclosed it to you, first of all?
I can't really answer that because that will give me away.
Okay, go ahead and just tell me everything that you told me again.
I'm a very close friend of his. I know him better than anyone else.
Okay.
He's a really good liar. He has a lot of problems, and he has a lot of problems, actually.
Okay. So what do his problems stem from?
His problems come from family. He's always had a messed up life, and I've always tried to be there for him. But then after this, I couldn't, because he's going to hurt more people, and I can't just, I can't.
Okay. What's your concern about remaining anonymous?
The reason why I don't. If he finds out it's me, because if he finds out it's me, he's gonna try to after me, or try to get his friends after me, and I don't want that to happen.
Following this phone call, Daniel Marsh was arrested. Daniel William Marsh had been born to parents Bill and Sherry on the 14th of May, 1997. His courage and quick thinking garnered local attention in 2008, when at the tender age of 10, he received the American Red Cross Heroes Award for using CPR to save his father, who had suffered a heart attack. Bill and Marsh were at home when Bill began experiencing symptoms of a heart attack. He bundled his son into the car, but he blacked out while on the way to Sutter Davis Hospital, with his foot still on the gas pedal. 10-year-old Marsh sprang into action, grabbing the steering wheel from the passenger seat and veering the car away from oncoming traffic until it crashed into a wall. Drawing from his admiration for the TV show House, Marsh recalled a technique he had seen, promptly administering chest compressions and ultimately reviving his father. Marsh later recollected, "I started yelling and banging on his chest, trying to bring him back, and it did. If I didn't do anything and just sat there and waited for someone to help, my dad would have died." During the award ceremony, Marsh's parents looked on with swelling pride. Afterwards, his mother, Sherry, said to the Enterprise, "I'm extremely proud of my son and who he is." While his father, Bill, said that his son had the will of a warrior, no doubt about that. Are you still grappling with stress and struggling to maintain focus, despite making it a New Year's resolution? Truvaga offers a solution. This handheld device stimulates the vagus nerve, enhancing overall health and wellness. By stimulating the vagus nerve, Truvaga helps rebalance and strengthen the nervous system, leading to reduced stress, improved focus, enhanced mood, and better sleep. With customizable sessions lasting just 2 minutes each, incorporating one in the morning and one at night is easily achievable. Truvaga provides 355 sessions, enough for approximately 6 months of twice daily use. It's entirely drug-free, and it's straightforward to use, requiring no app or phone. Experience the benefits of improved health with Truvaga. It's a win-win situation. Visit truvaga.com, which is spelled truvaga.com, and enter the promo code Morbidology to enhance your wellness journey. Support this podcast and receive $15 off. That is truvaga.com. Check out promo code Morbidology. Do you enjoy treating yourself to life's little luxuries? Whether it's indulging in a gourmet coffee or seizing the opportunity of a sale, we all have our moments. But why settle when it comes to your health and finding the right doctor? Enter ZocDoc. It's the solution you've been searching for. ZocDoc is your free ticket to convenience and peace of mind. With their app and website, you can effortlessly search and compare top-rated, in-network doctors in your area. No more endless phone calls or waiting on hold. Just browse, choose, and book your appointment instantly. Plus, with verified reviews from real patients, you can trust you're making the right choice. From routine checkups to specialized care, ZocDoc's network of doctors covers virtually every medical need. Trust me, if I had ZocDoc when I was doctor hunting a few years back, life would have been a breeze. Go to ZocDoc.com/morbidology and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That is ZocDoc.com/morbidology. ZocDoc.com/morbidology. In the same year, Marsh's family life took a tumultuous turn when his father discovered his mother's affair with their son's former kindergarten teacher. The revelation sparked a bitter divorce and custody battle between Bill and Sherry, leaving Marsh and his older sister Sarah caught in the crossfire. Their once spacious 5-bedroom home on Marina Circle fell into foreclosure, forcing Sherry to relocate to Lillard Drive, while Bill settled into a condominium on Cowell Boulevard. It was just 2 doors away from Oliver and Claudia. Marsh found himself primarily residing with his father, separated from his sister, who lived with their mother. The abrupt upheaval shattered the stability Marsh had known, plunging him into a deep state of depression. His resentment towards his mother and sister festered, manifesting in disturbing thoughts of violence. Struggling to cope, Marsh's mental anguish manifested physically as he developed an eating disorder. In the latter half of 2011, Bill sought help for his son, enrolling him in a Kaiser eating disorder outpatient program in Sacramento. However, Marsh's condition proved more severe than anticipated, necessitating intensive treatment at a companion Kaiser Hospital program in Berkeley. The 6-week ordeal left Marsh deeply scarred, further complicating his already troubled psyche. As Marsh grappled with his identity, his mental well-being took a sharp decline, plunging deeper into depression. Seeking solace in alcohol and marijuana, he often spiraled into vodka-fueled binges, yet found no relief from his increasingly bleak thoughts. In April of 2012, tensions reached a boiling point during a heated argument with his father over his drinking habits, resulting in Marsh getting kicked out of his father's home. Returning to live with his mother and sister, Marsh's inner turmoil continued to fester. His anger found destructive outlets, targeting birds, a cat, and a raccoon before his descent reached a critical point. In December of 2012, he was involuntarily hospitalized for depression. Sherry had taken him to the emergency room, where he spoke with nurse Patricia Prentice. Opening up about his struggles, Marsh admitted to grappling with uncontrollable anger and a volatile relationship with his mother. Despite previous prescriptions, Marsh consistently rejected his medication, opting instead for self-medication through alcohol. Alarming the nurse, Marsh confessed to frequently suicidal thoughts and recounted 3 failed attempts, including an overdose on morphine, drinking himself to death, and standing on the train tracks, but the train switched tracks to avoid him. Upon Marsh's discharge from the hospital, his return to Davis Senior High School didn't alleviate his ongoing struggles. In a candid conversation with Monica O'Brien, a counsellor from the Yolo County Office of Education, Marsh disclosed years of battling suicidal thoughts and said he was frustrated at the lack of improvement. These troubling thoughts weren't isolated to self-harm. Marsh confided his unsettling fantasies of harming others, including fellow students. With an eerie smile, Marsh recounted these dark daydreams, vividly describing gruesome scenarios of mutilation. Despite his efforts to manage these intrusive thoughts with marijuana or alcohol, Marsh admitted they lingered incessantly. While Monica felt a rapport with Marsh, her duty to prioritize student safety led her to alert the authorities about his troubling revelations. Meanwhile, Marsh's father, Bill, sought custody of him and his older sister, Sarah, expressing genuine concern for their well-being and safety. However, despite Bill's pleas, on the 8th of March, Yolo Superior Court Judge Kathleen White awarded sole custody of Marsh to his mother, Sherry, granting her full legal authority for his medical and psychiatric treatment. After Daniel Marsh was arrested, he was taken to Davis Police Headquarters to be interviewed. Despite his alleged confessions to close friends, a nagging doubt gnawed at the detectives' minds. They were acutely aware of his fragile state, and this raised the unsettling possibility that his admissions could be nothing more than desperate cries for attention or manifestations of his psychological turmoil. At the crime scene, there was not a single piece of evidence left behind, and detectives found it unlikely that a teenage boy could orchestrate such a crime without leaving behind any DNA or fingerprints. Daniel Marsh reluctantly took a seat across from Detective Ariel Pineda and FBI Special Agent Campon. They first of all asked him what he was doing over the weekend that Oliver and Claudia were killed.
Can you tell me where you were? I should have been at my house with my mom. On the weekends, I usually just stay there.
What were you doing?
Probably playing video games or playing guitar. Usually what I do on my weekends is either I have somebody over or I just hang out and play video games or play music.
You met
what you're doing that specific weekend?
Not exactly, but I don't really go places other than my friend's house, so I know that I don't think we hung out that weekend. I'm pretty sure I was at my house, and if I wasn't at my house, then I was at his house.
With his hands clasped together and his back hunched over in the seat, Marsh told detectives that he had heard about the murders of Oliver and Claudia. But everybody in the town had.
Well, to be honest, I mean, it's Davis. When something like that happens here, it's like, holy crap. Everybody knows about it, hears about it.
Tell me what you know about it.
I think they were, like, an elderly couple or something. I know that somebody broke in and, like, stabbed these two people, but I don't really know anything else. Breaking and entering.
Do you know which apartment that did that?
Well, not the actual one, no. But I know it was, like, near my dad's. I know we drove by it a couple times, and we saw, like, the police tape and everything.
Well, when was the last time you were there?
In that area?
Yeah.
Probably, like, a week after it happened or something like that. It was soon enough to where there was still the tape up and everything, and there were, like, all the cop cars were there.
Marsh said that his father in particular was shaken, since he had lived just two doors away from the victims. He said, it freaked him out. The people next door are dead, and you're like, whoa, that could have been us. The detectives then told Marsh that they wanted to clear up some rumours they had heard, referring to his confession to his friend and girlfriend.
Well, I'm just also trying to clear up some things, maybe some rumours and maybe some information regards to you and the murder investigation that we're doing and the murders that happened on Cowell.
What?
Is there anything you can tell me?
I haven't heard any of these rumors that you, like, I haven't heard anything about it. I haven't heard anyone say anything about me in regards to it. Like, honestly, I haven't heard anything about me in regards to that. I don't know why it would be there. Why people would, anyone would spread a rumor.
What if it becomes more than a rumor? Or if you have more information that you may have something to do with it?
But I don't.
How can you prove to me that you don't?
Pretty sure if you ask my mom, she'll say I was there. I don't know. How would anyone else prove that? I mean, I know if you're looking for an alibi, that would be it.
The topic of the interrogation then switched to Marsh's home life.
So 9 years old, what do you mean, bro? Your parents split?
Yeah, like, parents split, mom disappeared for a few months, left with dad who was, well, he has a temper problem, and, you know, just lost his wife, so he's going to be pissed off, and so that wasn't really fun. And since then, every year it seems like, you know, there's a new, like, bad thing to happen or a new crock of to be added into the pile. It was really selfish, honestly, because, like, she left with a chick, like, and I don't know what happened with that, but she was involved in my life for a few years.
He spoke about the anger he felt towards his mother after she abandoned the family for another woman.
And that pissed me off, because it's like, really, you care about your own happiness more than your children's. That's not right. The way I see it, when you're a parent, it's kind of, you made it your duty to nurture your kids and take care of them and make sure that they're okay.
The detectives then asked Marsh what kind of relationship he had with his father.
Not good. He never hit me or my sister, but he'd hit, like, the walls, or he'd hit, like, you know, inanimate objects. He'd yell, and it's that kind of stereotypical, just pissed off dad.
Marsh then spoke about his older sister, Sarah.
She was a really bad attention-seeking, habitual liar, a manipulator of my parents. And, you know, when you're a little kid and you see that she's manipulating them and you try to tell them, they don't believe you because you're just a kid and you don't know what's going on, supposedly.
Yeah.
The topic of the conversation then turned a little bit darker. Detectives had learned that Marsh had a Tumblr blog, where he had been posting graphic photographs and videos.
I don't know, not a lot of stuff makes me laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, I like horror movies, and it's just, it's the same thing as a horror movie, only it's real, in the sense that I don't have any connection to whoever it happened to. It doesn't really bother me.
Right. So, and it's kind of like the cutting, it's a feeling, right?
Yeah, seriously. Like, it makes me feel something, and I've just always kind of been into darker stuff.
And what do you feel when you say it makes you feel something? What is it that you're feeling when you see the stuff on Tumblr, the gore?
I don't know. It makes me kind of like shocked and I'm fascinated with anatomy. And so like you can see what happened to them and how warped their bodies are, and just it's kind of fascinating to think like, what could have done that? How did that happen? Why did that happen? Just how did this all come to play? And I don't know. Sometimes they'll be like in a funny pose or something, and they'll just look right, like stupid. And so I'll like giggle at it.
After this, the detectives told Marsh that his friend had told them that he confessed to the murders to him in great detail.
Me?
Mm-hmm.
That's ridiculous.
Why is it ridiculous?
I'm a kid.
No, that's...
Well, like, I don't hurt people. Like, you can ask anyone around me. I'm a compassionate, affectionate person. I care about people. I don't want to hurt them. I mean, yeah, they piss me off sometimes, and they do some messed up shit, but I care about people.
The detectives made it clear that they didn't believe Marsh.
Well, we have this issue then. We still have this problem.
Yeah.
And it's a big problem because somebody knows a lot of information, stuff that only somebody who was there is gonna know. And we look at that, and we look at your Tumblr page, and we look at everything that I understand about people in your position that I've met along the way in 25 years of doing this. And people are saying, it's Dan. That's Dan. And he did it, and here's why.
They probed him for answers, their relentless questioning slowly chipping away at his resolve. As the interrogation wore on, Marsh's facade began to crumble, his protests giving way to desperate pleas for the detectives to believe him. Eventually, he realized that the detectives already knew that it was him who had killed Oliver and Claudia.
That night, I couldn't take it anymore. I had to do it. I lost control of myself.
He said that on the night of the murders, he lost control after fantasizing about murder for some years. Sometime between 2 a.m. and 3 a.m. that he snuck out of his mother's home. He was dressed in all black, including a black ski mask that was covering his face. He said that he wore gloves and put tapes on the bottom of his shoes to prevent any footprints. He was carrying a 6-inch buck knife as he prowled the quiet streets. He was hoping to come across a home that had an unlocked door or window.
Wandered around for a while, just looking for who would be, which house I should go to, who would be a good... Okay.
Marsh had already checked around 50 doors and windows when he came to Oliver and Claudia's home and found what he was looking for. Marsh had met the elderly couple a couple of years earlier when they invited him and his father over to their home after they moved in. That night, Oliver and Claudia had left open a window, so Marsh sliced open the screen and quietly crept inside.
I got a hole in the screen, not even a hole, just a flap that I could get in and out with. climbed in through the back. I listened for snoring, and I heard it. Went to their bedroom. I opened the door. And I just kind of stood over their bed watching them sleep for a few minutes. My body was trembling. I was nervous, but excited and exhilarated. I was actually going to do it. I was there.
Marsh described standing over Oliver and Claudia's bed as an out-of-body experience. But before he had decided what to do, Claudia woke up.
And the woman woke up. So I just started stabbing her. Over and over. Okay. All throughout the torso, and I tried to get... And then the husband woke up. And he looked over, and just as he looked over, I stabbed him in the neck. And then I went back to killing the woman because she wouldn't die.
You're stabbing her in the torso and she just wouldn't die?
Yeah. Like, I stabbed her a lot, as you obviously know. It took a long time. And it was a lot easier with the guy than it was with her.
The detectives pressed for some more information.
And that stopped him from resisting at that point?
Well, yeah. And then he was just, like, grabbing his neck, trying to stop it, and bleeding everywhere. It was, like, gargling and stuff.
Do you remember her saying anything to me, to you? You said that she was, told us that she was screaming some.
No, she gasped, and then she started screaming. She didn't scream that long after.
Okay. Did she say anything to you, though? Sometimes people, you know...
Oh, she begged me to stop.
Begged you? Like, what did she say?
Please stop. Please, please stop.
After Oliver and Claudia were evidently deceased, Marsh continued to stab their lifeless bodies, telling the detectives that it just felt right. But Marsh's elation didn't stop there. He said to detectives that killing Oliver and Claudia was the most enjoyable feeling he had ever felt in his entire life.
And I just kind of messed around with... I'd open both of their torsos around here. And the woman, I put a phone inside of her, and I put a cup inside the guy. I don't know why. I really don't.
After the confession, Marsh further told detectives that he had been harboring thoughts of killing people for years. The first time was when he was 6 years old, but by the time he had reached middle school, these thoughts had grown.
Every time I look at someone, in my mind, I see flashes of images of me killing them.
Okay.
In numerous ways, in numerous horrible ways, doing terrible things. I can't help it. It's just what comes into my head when I see them.
Right.
I don't want it to. I don't like that it does, but it does.
Right.
And that's around the time that that started.
These were other people at school, students?
It's with everyone.
Everyone.
Everyone I look at.
Okay.
Every time he looked at a person, he had thoughts of how he would kill them, and began having fantasies of committing a mass shooting at school. He sometimes pondered how many people he could kill before he was taken out by responding officers. Marsh said that after the murders, he was on a high for a few days and began making plans to carry out another murder. He said that his plan was to wander the streets of Davis at night and beat somebody to death with a baseball bat. But thankfully, on the night that he went out, he didn't come across anybody. After the confession, detectives obtained a search warrant for Sherry's home. In the garage, they found Marsh's bloody clothing, along with a black pilot's jacket that he had stolen from Oliver. He told detectives that he had taken the jacket as a souvenir. On the 18th of June, Marsh was charged as an adult with 2 counts of first-degree murder and was ordered to be held at the Yolo County Juvenile Detention Facility without bond. He was additionally charged with special circumstances including torture, lying in wait, and heinous and depraved murder. He was the first juvenile to be charged as an adult with multiple counts of murder in Yolo County, with the last being Leroy Lowry in 1993. He had stabbed his grandmother and her caretaker while high on drugs. Marsh subsequently pleaded not guilty, and the public defender's office was appointed to the case. While he was charged as an adult, he was not legally eligible for the death penalty, but if convicted, he could be facing a sentence of life in prison, although not without the possibility of parole. Assistant Chief Deputy District Attorney Michael Cabral, who was assigned to prosecute the case, said that if convicted, Marsh was most likely looking at a sentence of 25 years to life for each murder. The arrest and charges came as a welcome relief to Oliver and Claudia's family, with Mary commenting, "We can get together now to support each other in mourning, instead of supporting each other through a murder investigation." However, Mary had mixed feelings about the fact that Marsh was charged as an adult. She said that her father would have frowned upon this. With a wistful smile, she commented, "My dad would say, at 16 they should know better, but they can't think clearly. But I'm not into revenge, and I don't think my father would be into revenge." As the case was making its way through the justice system, Marsh's defense attorney, Ronald Johnson, requested closed proceedings in court. He argued that news coverage of the case, because of the brutal nature of it, could jeopardize his chance of a fair trial. Johnson stated, "The media surrounding Mr. Marsh has been extensive and sensational. The media coverage regarding the deaths of the victims has been pervasive, lasting for months." He cited more than 70 print, broadcast, and online items that year dedicated to the case, and mentioned how the Globe had referred to Marsh as a twisted teen and bloodthirsty monster. Despite his argument, the judge denied the motion, and he also denied requests for a protective order and to seal the preliminary hearing. The preliminary hearing began on the 13th of September, and it was determined that there was enough evidence against Marsh for him to stand trial. It was scheduled to begin in March of 2014, but before then, defense attorney Johnson asked that the torture charge against Marsh be dropped. In his motion, he argued, "There was nothing in the nature of the injuries to either to suggest that they were inflicted in an attempt at torture, as opposed to the intent to kill." The request was denied, and then the trial was pushed back until June. Marsh then returned to court on the 2nd of June and entered a new plea of not guilty by insanity. The new plea meant that the trial was pushed back again until August, as Judge David Reed appointed psychiatric experts. By the 2nd of September 2014, a jury was selected and seated, and the opening statements were ready to begin. Prosecutor Amanda Sambor played for the jury several snippets of Marsh's confession before telling them, "Manipulative, calculated, cunning and sadistic. These are all terms to describe Daniel Marsh. This is a deadly and dangerous combination." Defense attorney Johnson painted a different picture of Marsh, telling the jury that he had been driven by demons and persistent thoughts of killing. He said that these thoughts were fueled by the very drugs that doctors had prescribed him over the years to quell them. In his opening statements, he said that Marsh had been losing his inner battles with deepening depression and rage, and said that his mind often turned to extreme violence. He went on to cite failed attempts at therapy, involuntary commitments to hospital, and a mix of medication, including the antidepressant Zoloft and antipsychotic medications. He glanced from juror to juror as he confidently said, "More and more he becomes a prisoner of his own mind. This is what doctors are supposed to be looking for. Not one said maybe he should get off these medications." Testimony then got underway, with Monica O'Brien, a Yolo County Office of Education counsellor. She told the courtroom that in January of 2013, Marsh told her that he had been struggling with suicidal and homicidal thoughts for years. The emergency room nurse, Patricia Prentice, took the jury through her experience with him as well. James Rokop, a state clinical psychologist, testified next. He had interviewed Marsh for 6 hours in August and testified about his frame of mind. He said that he determined Marsh was suffering from major depressive disorder and that he had experienced severe depression. During their interview, Marsh had told Rokop that he had studied serial killers for years and often went on vodka drinking binges. He further told him that he had a growing obsession with sexually violent images that he found on the internet. Rokop found that Marsh's anger was a primary emotion directed at his family and strangers. He testified. His worldview was that everyone was a cockroach or a parasite. He had a general hate of everybody. He said he thought about killing a lot. He had a build-up of anger. While Marsh had spent over a year in custody, he still had these thoughts and described the murders of Oliver and Claudia as good as opium, if not better. During their interview, Marsh had also referred to Oliver and Claudia as stupid Davis people who leave their doors open and said that they were basically nobody to him. The jury also heard evidence about Marsh's anorexia and his depression. The testimony continued focusing on his dark thoughts, as Detective Brett Boering divulged text messages that he had sent to a friend. Marsh had told this friend that he dreamed of torturing and killing people. He further testified that when he examined Marsh's internet history, he had been looking up gore, torture, and serial killers. The day before Olivia and Claudia were killed, he had looked up gruesome photographs of beheadings and mutilations, something which he frequently posted on his Tumblr blog. The jury also learned that when Marsh was younger, he had planned on killing a former friend who he had believed stole his girlfriend. Marsh had told his therapist that he did everything he could not to kill this friend. According to the prosecution, this was evidence that he should... According to the prosecution, this was evidence that he showed he was in control of his anger. Before the trial came to an end, the jury was presented with the full interrogation and confession. In part of the confession, Marsh detailed how long he had been thinking about killing people for.
So let's go back to the first time you thought about killing someone. How long ago was that?
Years ago.
How many years? Six, you're like 10.
When I was 10, I thought about and plotted about killing the woman that my mother left my father for.
Your kindergarten teacher?
Yes.
Because you were so angry at her?
Yeah.
Okay.
I saw her as the reason that my family was ripped apart, and in a way, she was a big part of that.
So she was going to be held responsible. Okay? So what were you going to do at age 10? What was your plan?
With all of the evidence presented, it was time for closing arguments. Prosecutor Zambor portrayed Marsh as a remorseless killer who acted out on his violent and homicidal thoughts. She said to the jury, "He went into that house and murdered Oliver and Claudia as they lay in their bed. He was proud of it and remains proud of it. He laughed when he described what he did." She reminded the jury how Marsh was able to control his anger and not kill his friend who he believed stole his girlfriend, telling them, "It shows he's in control of his anger, and it's why predatory violence is so important in this case. Predatory violence. That's what happened in this case. He was a predator searching the streets of Davis, looking for somebody to kill." She also said that there was no evidence to show that Marsh's behaviour and actions were the result of the antidepressants he was on. She said that neither he nor the doctors had previously noted any side effects from the prescription drugs. On the other hand, defense attorney Johnson countered this. He said that Marsh was in a dissociative state during the murders, and that combined with the antidepressants he was on, left him unable to understand the gravity of his actions. He said to the jury, "He's spinning out of control. He's taking the drugs. They're not working." Less than 24 hours after the closing arguments, the jury returned with the verdict. They found Daniel Marsh guilty of first-degree murder. They also determined that he lay in wait and tortured Oliver and Claudia. Outside of court, Oliver and Claudia's family gathered and expressed gratitude at the swift verdict. One of Claudia's daughters, Victoria Hurd, said through tears, "We're pleased and grateful the jury did the right thing. We feel that justice was served today. My mother and Oliver were the greatest people. They didn't deserve this." The verdict paved the way for the upcoming sanity phase. If Marsh were found to be insane, then he would be sent to a state hospital for treatment, as opposed to prison. Marsh returned to court on the 30th of September, and the jury found that he was sane, quickly rejecting his plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. Before the jury left that afternoon, most of them requested counselling. The horrific details of the trial had left them feeling traumatized and shaken. One who asked to not be identified commented, "It was very bad. None of us were able to go to sleep. The details. It was very difficult." On the 12th of December, Daniel Marsh was sentenced to 53 years in prison. The judge had sentenced him to the maximum of 25 years to life, plus an extra year for the use of a knife for each victim. In handing down the sentence, Judge Reed said, "The murders in this case were brutal. The victims were random. He tortured them and took pleasure in what he had done. He told his friends. He slaughtered Oliver and Claudia out of morbid curiosity. This is a sad case. They did not deserve to die. They did not deserve to be killed by Daniel." Marsh was sent to a juvenile detention centre until he turned 18, when he was sent to state prison. But then in March of 2018, his sentence was reversed by a state appeals panel, and the case was put to a juvenile judge. Proposition 57 had come into effect, which required that judges, not prosecutors, determine whether minors should be tried in adult or juvenile court. This opened up the possibility that Marsh could be freed at the age of 25, if the judge determined he should be tried as a minor. Marsh returned to court on the 1st of October, and testimony was presented about his mental state. His probation officer described how doctors found him mature beyond his years, and a sophisticated, manipulative killer. He also revealed that Marsh had been diagnosed as a psychopath, somebody who exhibits a cluster of personality traits and behaviours, characterised by a lack of empathy, remorse and conscience, as well as a tendency towards manipulativeness, superficial charm and antisocial behaviour. The probation officer said that Marsh's case belonged in an adult court for these reasons, combined with the brutal nature of the double murder. Oliver and Claudia's family were thrust back into the details of the gruesome case, and they were allowed to present victim impact statements. Claudia's daughter, Victoria, tearfully said, "My parents were viciously stabbed, eviscerated, and staged in a freakish crime scene like something out of a bad horror movie. We, their family, have the daily punishment of knowing exactly how he tortured them. Coming to grips with this is the life sentence I live with every day. I ask the court please give our family some relief from the suffering by upholding his original conviction of 52 years to life." Claudia's granddaughter, Sarah, said that not everybody is capable of being rehabilitated, regardless of their age, and she accused Marsh of trying to manipulate the system. Sarah's wife, Patty, stated. This is what you need to understand. He committed the perfect crime. He would not have gotten caught had he not bragged to his friends. At 15, he was accomplished enough, sophisticated enough, brilliant enough to commit the perfect crime. At 15. Imagine what he could do at 25, 30, 35. He is a psychopath who will kill again. During the hearing, Marsh also testified on his own behalf and claimed that he was a different person than the teenager who had committed the murders. He said that his gleeful reaction to the murders back when he was 16 horrified him now that he was 21 years old. According to Marsh, he was disgusted in himself. He offered an apology to the families, telling them, "Nothing I ever say or do will be enough. I'm sorry I took them away from you. I'm sorry for all that pain that I've caused you, that I'm sure I'm still causing you. I'm sorry for every horrible thing that you've gone through because of me, and if I could undo it, I would. I know that until I truly process what I did, I can't really give you the apology you deserve. I can't even bring myself to look at you. And I know that you don't think I'm being genuine. But I hope that to some extent, you're able to receive this because I'm truly sorry." Marsh claimed for the very first time that his childhood was marred by abuse. He said that there was violence, drug, and alcohol abuse, and said that he had been sexually abused starting at the age of 4. He refused to go into detail, but told the judge it made him feel like an object rather than a human being. He said that these experiences gave way to struggles with bullying, anorexia, suicidal thoughts, and homicidal urges before he was eventually hospitalized. Marsh glanced towards the floor as he said that his parents had left him largely unsupervised, and he had spent hours and hours watching gruesome videos on the internet. He said that he turned to alcohol and marijuana to try and quiet the dark thoughts that were plaguing his mind. According to Marsh, things improved when he moved to the R.J. Donovan Correctional Facility in San Diego, where he developed a deep connection with his psychologist. He said that he had since learned how to manage his anger and take responsibility for his mistakes. Marsh told the judge that he no longer struggled with mental illness or feelings of hate, telling him, "I was a really damaged, sick, screwed up kid, so I don't blame anybody for seeing me through that lens. In the end, all I can do is try. This is who I am. I'm not how I used to be." But Prosecutor Zambor wasn't buying Marsh's story.
In your prison records, you repeatedly tell your therapist you cannot remember the offense. Is that true?
That's what I've told him, but it's not true.
Why would you say that?
Because I haven't wanted to remember it.
Why not?
Because it was unbelievably horrific and horrendous, and it's hard for me to even wrap my mind around how I could have done something that awful. And I guess I've just been afraid to actually face that.
She suggested that he made up the allegations of physical and sexual abuse by his family in order to influence the proceedings, noting that for years he had denied any abuse to police and psychologists. She pressed him to name his alleged sexual abuser, but he refused. The judge ultimately rejected the bid to have Marsh's case remanded to the juvenile system, meaning that the 52-year sentence still stands. For years, Daniel Marsh had been in a downward spiral. After the divorce of his parents, his mental health took a nosedive, and thoughts of suicide crept into thoughts of homicide. Oliver and Claudia just so happened to live two doors away from him, and on one warm night, they made the mistake of leaving their window open.
Thank you.
Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd love to say a massive thank you to my newest supporter up on Patreon, Amanda. You can join Morbidology up on Patreon for as little as $1 a month, and there are absolutely no obligations. You can cancel your subscription at any time. In exchange for your support, I upload ad-free and early release episodes, bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast platforms, behind the scenes, and I also send out a handwritten thank you card along with some merch. Patreon seriously helps independent shows continue to run, and as a one-woman show, I genuinely do appreciate the support. If you'd like to support the show in another way, please consider leaving me a rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you may be listening. It's a super easy way to support a show that you like, and I genuinely appreciate the feedback. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.